This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy. World leaders have been congratulating the projected president-elect Joe Biden on his victory over U.S. President Donald Trump. Among them are German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, a Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, French President Emmanuel Macron, and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
The United States is our closest and most important ally, and that's been the case under president after president, prime minister after prime minister. It won't change. And I look forward very much to working with President Biden and his team on a lot of crucial stuff for us.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in sent out brief messages on his social media account Sunday, expressing support for the former U.S. vice president and his running mate, Senator Kamala Harris. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump has promised legal action after leveling accusations of large-scale voter fraud in the state of Pennsylvania, as well as other states that broke for Biden. AP correspondent Shelley Adler has details.
Republican Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri says
it's time for the president's lawyers to present the facts, and then it's time for those facts to speak for themselves.
But Democratic Senator Chris Coons says there's no proof of any fraud.
If Republicans are going to support President Trump in his resistance to accepting the outcome of the election, the president needs to show some facts, not just angry tweets.
Joining Coons and Blunt on ABC's This Week, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
Stop the rancor. Stop the fighting. We have real problems. Let's move on together.
I'm Shelley Adler.
And you can find more at voanews.com. Again, that is voanews.com. This is VOA News. Closing out another weekend, the United States continues to set more records for COVID-19 deaths and infections. We get more from AP correspondent Ben Thomas.
Johns Hopkins University's tally shows the country reported more than 126,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 Saturday, while more than 1,000 people died from the infection. The seven-day rolling averages have also been rising. New cases up from more than 64,000 2 weeks ago to nearly 104,000, while daily deaths have risen from 801 to 930. There have been more than 9.9 million cases, and more than 237,000 people have died from the virus in the U.S. since the pandemic started. Worldwide, confirmed cases have now passed the 50 million mark, with more than 1.25 million deaths. I'm Ben Thomas.
A strengthening tropical storm had sliced across Cuba Sunday and heads for the southern tip of Florida, where officials braced for a storm that could hit a hurricane force after leaving scores dead and over 100 missing in Mexico and Central America. The U.S. National Hurricane Center in Miami declared hurricane and storm surge warnings for the Keys from Ocean Reef to the Dry Tortugas, including Florida Bay, with the storm expected to reach that area by Sunday night or early Monday. Florida officials closed beaches, ports, and COVID testing sites, shut down public transportation, and urged residents to stay off the street. Ethiopia's prime minister has announced major changes to the country's military and intelligence leadership as he seeks to defend a growing military action against the country's defiant Tigray region. He has urged citizens not to target the ethnic Tigrayan people amid fears of civil war. An aid group says that at least 60 people have been wounded and 6 killed in one location along the Tigray border, and the United Nations warns of major humanitarian crises if millions flee all out fighting or if the heavily armed Tigray region remains almost completely cut off from the world. 4 astronauts have arrived at Florida's Kennedy Space Center for SpaceX's second crew launch next weekend. This time, there are twice as many astronauts as the test flight earlier this year, and the mission will last for full 6 months. The 3 Americans and 1 Japanese astronaut flew into Kennedy from Houston Sunday. They're scheduled to rocket away Saturday night to the International Space Station. For NASA, it does mark the long-awaited start of regular crew rotations, with private companies providing the lifts. The astronauts have named their capsule Resilience, given all the challenges of the year 2020. Again, more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Michelle from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, November 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ethiopia's prime minister makes changes to his government amid conflict in the Tigray region.
What I read from this situation is that basically the status quo, I believe, will continue, and there will not be a major policy shift as far as the government is concerned.
Egyptians voted Saturday in the second phase of their parliamentary election. Guinea's main opposition leader criticizes the constitutional court for siding with President Conde. In Nigeria, a call to exonerate Ken Saro Wiwa and the so-called Ogoni Nine. And Ivory Coast opposition demands the unconditional release of its leaders.
President Bidye is under blockade because his residence is surrounded by the police and the gendarmerie. He's prevented from moving outside. He's not free of his movement.
And an outdoor art exhibition has opened in Dakar, Senegal. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed made changes to his government over the weekend in the midst of a military campaign in the country's northern Tigray region. Prime Minister Ahmed Sunday replaced his army chief, intelligence head, and the foreign minister. The prime minister gave no reason for the changes. Getachew Metaferia is an Ethiopian-born professor of political science at Morgan State University outside Washington, D.C. He says the changes will have little effect on the Tigray conflict.
What I read from this situation is that we have not seen any new faces or new blood. Therefore, it is not a major shift. It is basically the status quo, I believe, will continue, and there will not be a major policy shift as far as the government is concerned.
I want to focus a little bit on the foreign minister. What does the replacement of the foreign minister mean in terms of the prime minister's willingness to seek a diplomatic solution? As you know, there have been efforts to get a diplomatic solution.
Well, the new Minister of Foreign Affairs, who used to be and who is still, is Vice Prime Minister. He's also a seasoned political leader. But between him and Gedjo, who is now the Prime Minister's National Security Advisor, I don't think there is major policy or ideological differences between both of them. As far as the situation on the ground is concerned, all of them assume or believe that the TPLF, which is now in Tigray, is the one that has created the problem. A lot of efforts were made to bring them back to peace and for negotiation, and that failed. So I don't think there is, as far as foreign policy is concerned, there's not going to be a drastic change from the previous policy posture.
The Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, led Ethiopia's ruling coalition for decades before Prime Minister Abiy took office in 2018. Now, to what extent is this conflict one of ethnic differences or the old regime trying to regain power?
What they call ethnic difference, basically something that is created by the TPLF itself. The Ethiopians used to live and lived as Ethiopians, and there wasn't, the ethnic difference was not very much pronounced before the TPLF came to power. The TPLF came to power in 1991 and had been there since 2019. It had basically created, crafted a new dynamism, a new thinking in Ethiopia, divided the country into ethnic and linguistic based regions, which is unknown in Ethiopia. And they also use this divide and rule mechanism since they are minority ethnic groups. So they started to inflame these ethnic differences. Actual individuals who claim that they are Ethiopians, nationality wise, they were told that they are not Ethiopians. They have to declare their ethnic background, sending them back to their ethnic cocoons. So that did not go well with most of the Ethiopians, and because they felt that this Ethiopian nation building had taken place for centuries. It's not something new. So they were trying to undermine that edifice of the Ethiopian persona, and they wanted to reduce Ethiopians to their ethnic and linguistic enclaves That, again, is a ploy of divide and rule.
Getachew Metaferia is the Ethiopian-born professor of political science at Morgan State University outside Washington, D.C. You're speaking with us from the state of Maryland. Egypt began the second phase of elections for its lower chamber of parliament on Saturday in 13 of the country's 27 provinces. A runoff election will be held in several weeks to determine the final winners. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Egyptian media showed voters turning out Saturday morning to cast their ballots at polling stations in half of the country that didn't vote during an earlier round last month. Music blared as poll workers welcomed voters to cast ballots in Ismailia amid strict security and COVID-19 health precautions. Egyptian state TV showed President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi casting his ballot at a polling station in a Cairo suburb not far from the presidential palace. The president urged Egyptians to perform their civic duty and vote. Egyptian security forces were out in force to make sure voting went smoothly. Lashine Ibrahim, head of Egypt's National Electoral Commission, told journalists the judiciary was overseeing voting in the 9,468 polling stations opened Saturday during the second phase of parliamentary elections. Polling stations, he added, are being sterilized to prevent the spread of COVID-19. He says the Electoral Commission contracted with outside parties to sterilize polling stations at the outset of voting on both Saturday and Sunday, and at the close of voting both days. President Sisi's Future of the Nation party put in the strongest showing in the first phase of voting several weeks ago. Egypt's semi-official Al-Ahram newspaper reported that voter turnout was 28.06% of nearly 31 million eligible voters in the first round. 63 million Egyptians are eligible to vote in both rounds of the election, and voters could face a $30 fine if they do not vote. Such fines, however, are rarely imposed. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The opposition in Ivory Coast has called for the immediate and unconditional release of what it calls political prisoners who it said were illegally detained by President Alassane Ouattara's government. The group says opposition leader Henri Konan-Bédié, who has been under virtual house arrest since a week ago, continues to lead. Soon after the Electoral Commission declared President Ouattara the winner of the October election, the opposition established a National Transitional Council, a parallel government, because they said President Ouattara's election for a third term violates the constitution. The government accuses the opposition of sedition. Youssoufou Joseph Bamba is a former permanent representative of Cote d'Ivoire to the United Nations and now a member of the opposition.
Yes, we had very disturbing news before. We heard that he has been arrested and has been in very, very dire condition. But recently, 1 hour ago, I've read the news, so he's well and alive, and he has spoken, and the video is available on the social media. So my answer to Mr. Pascal Afinissan is alive and well. He's under custody, of course, but he's well and alive.
Ambassador, what can you tell us about your leader, Konan-Bédié? The last we heard over the weekend that his house was surrounded or blockaded. What do you know?
Yeah, Konan-Bédié is under blockade because his residence is surrounded by the police and the gendarmerie. He's prevented from moving outside. He's not free of his movement. Is inside with his wife. Of course, we have a reason to be concerned, but his morale is high. He's a fighter, and he wants to surrender to the blackmail. They want to do what he is victim of blackmail, but he wants to surrender. President Bédié is a symbol and the leader of the opposition, and everybody is united around him. And Mr. Bédié is a true, a real statesman. He stands for his value, and we fight on the life is determined and the Ivorian people will follow him.
The government says that the opposition's declaration of a transitional council is tantamount to terrorism or a kind of coup d'etat. What do you make of that?
I totally reject that. Quite the contrary, is the Mr. Ouattara regime who has perpetrated a constitutional coup d'etat because the election was a rigged election. Conditions were not adequate to hold those elections. The opposition has repeatedly, relentlessly asked for the postponement of this election to permit a national consensus on the very contentious point, namely the Electoral Commission, which is totally one-sided. Is totally all the 600 people who man that body are from the RHDP, and that's one point. The other point, and the most important, was the illegal and unconstitutional candidacy of Mr. Ouattara. According to Article 55 of our constitution, Mr. Ouattara could not run.
Youssoufou Joseph Bamba is the former permanent representative of Cote d'Ivoire to the United Nations and now a member of the opposition. You're speaking with us from New York. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Mbati in Washington. Today is Monday, November 9th. An advisor to Guinean opposition leader Selou Dalein Diallo says the country's constitutional court missed an opportunity to strengthen democracy in Guinea. Instead, Ousmane Diallo, political advisor and director of communications for opposition leader Selou Dalein Diallo's UFD party, said the court's decision increased uncertainty about Guinea's stability. He was reacting to Saturday's confirmation of President Alpha Condé's victory in the October 18 presidential election by the court. In its ruling on Saturday, the court rejected the opposition claims of fraud, saying the opposition presented no evidence to prove its claims. Diallo says President Condé's election for a third term was not only illegal, but a setback for democracy in Guinea and Africa in general.
President Selou Dalein Diallo is challenging the court's expected decision.
The Constitutional Court said that your party provided no evidence to your claim of fraud. Your reaction?
We heard the court say that we did not find evidence, unfortunately. This court missed the opportunity to strangle democracy in our country and increase uncertainty about Guinea's stability.
Mr. Diallo, the last time we spoke, I asked whether you have confidence in the Guinean judiciary. I will ask that question again. Do you have confidence in the court?
My answer is invariable. We have the court's decision reinforce our doubts about its ability to say the law and its independence from the president of the republic. Today, unfortunately, all institutions are controlled by Alpha Condé. That's why our democracy is broken.
In a way, the re-election of President Condé is similar to that of President Alassane Ouattara in Cote d'Ivoire. Do you think that these two examples have helped to advance or hinder democracy in Africa?
Absolutely. The elections that are carried out of result of manipulation of the institution are setback for democracy in Africa. Both presidents are very old and have chosen their interests at the expense of democracy and development of their country. It's also a challenge for the new generation, which must redouble its effort to strengthen their democracy institution.
Your leader, Selou Dalein Diallo, contested the election, even though some key members of the opposition boycotted. Does Mr. Selou Dalein Diallo have any regret for going into the election alone?
We are right to participate in the electoral competition. This has demonstrated to the world an ability to bring Guinea together and our wilderness to unity and together for development. President Selou Dalein is more than ever the choice of the people, while Alpha Condé appears clearly as a putschist.
Ousmane Diallo is the political advisor and director of communications for Guinean opposition leader Selou Dalein Diallo's UFDG party. You're speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. Tomorrow, November 9, will mark 25 years since Ken Sarawiwa and eight other Ogoni activists were executed by the Nigerian government led by General Sani Abacha. Sarawiwa was an environmental activist who fought against the pollution and degradation of Ogoni land by the Royal Dutch Shell Oil Company. As leader of the movement for the survival of the Goni people, Mausab, Sarawiwa also wanted economic and political autonomy for the people of Ogoniland. The so-called Ogoni Nine had been tried and found guilty by a military tribunal of murder with no appeal. Fegalo Unsuke is the president of Mausab. He says as part of the 25th anniversary commemoration, Mausab is calling on the federal government of Nigeria to exonerate the Ogoni Nine.
The focus of this year's memorial is that given that they were innocent people, we're asking the government to clear their names. We're asking the government to exonerate them because they never committed the crime for which they were executed. We are going to have church sessions. We are going to have people coming from other parts of Nigeria make speeches. And then we are going to visit the gravesite of Ken Sarawiwa and several other activities. We are going to have the cultural displays in line with our tradition as Ogoni people, as indigenous people.
Mausab is calling on the federal government to initiate a move to clear the names of the so-called Ogoni Nine. How do you hope this can happen?
Well, we have done a formal request to the government. We expect the government to respond appropriately because that exoneration is going to build a lot of goodwill and is going to help the reconciliation process. Most of it is considering that it's also time that we also need to focus on the development of Ogoni. We need to focus on what is good for the Ogoni people. But we don't forget that the Ogoni people are very seriously pained by what happened in 1995. It's been very difficult for Ogoni people to actually recover from those murders. However, we must move Ogoni forward. We must act in the way that we consider best for Ogoni to get the good things for Ogoni. So we see the exoneration as one thing, one act that can actually help build goodwill and help the reconciliation process.
Now, Ken Sarawiwa was an activist, and one of the things he was passionate about was the pollution of the Ogoni land. How is the process going now for cleaning up of the Ogoni land?
Well, unfortunately, the cleanup process hasn't been transparent. And so it's even difficult for me as president of Mausab to tell you exactly what they are doing or what they have done. It's not been transparent. There is no briefing, no media briefing to educate the people on what is going on. We only hope that by the end of the day, we can do a verification to see that at least it's better than what it was. But honestly, we are very sure that what they are doing right now is not a proper cleanup. Everything is secretive, and that tells us that there is something they are hiding. They aren't really doing things rightly. One of the most critical recommendations of the UNEP report was that there should be provision of water for the Ogoni people. That hasn't been done. And so everything has focused on what puts money in people's pockets.
Fegalo Unsuke is the president of the Movement for the Survival of Ogoni People of Nigeria. He was speaking with us from Port Harcourt, Nigeria. Senegalese curator and artist Modu Dieng just opened a citywide outdoor exhibition in Dakar, but he hopes the exhibition is just the first step. Dieng tells Rikish Triac about hopes of launching a conference next year centering on cultural conversation between artists from Africa and the diaspora, where they can create new ways of addressing issues that affect Black culture throughout the globe.
And the first actually Black Congress happened in 1957 in Paris, and the leader of that were Alun Job and Senghor and Ambassador, who were all, you know, from this platform around negritude that was really a way of sort of like injecting a new energy in our, you know, young country and injecting a new energy in our African diaspora and sort of communicate through that channel and make new ways of thinking philosophically about who we are. So you are grateful the way you are is following that trend by sort of, you know, leaning onto, you know, the success of many artists of Black origin.
And how do you want the discussion to go forward? You talked about having a conference maybe next year, Wind Dakar's Biennale. What do you want to see come out of that conversation?
Well, yes, you know, like to me, it's a work in progress. To me, you are beautiful the way you are is first an exhibition, and it's first like, you know, following the tradition of exhibiting work by artists, speaking of their vision and speaking of their aesthetic and speaking of their culture. And the next chapter to me was to sort of convey that kind of like platform into more of a forum and more of a conference, and leaning onto what's been done in the past around negritude, the discourse of negritude, which, like I said, happened during the first Black Congress. What would be the result, the outcome? I think it's a conversation. You know, I think we need to talk to each other. I think the people of America, the people of Europe, the people of Africa, the Africans and their diaspora, you know, need to support all of these voices.
What role does culture play in the global conversation over Black Lives Matter, over political movements, over white supremacy?
Well, I think what we need to remind ourselves is that, art, philosophy, literature, cinema, you know, music, all those cultures are here to sort of, you know, temper our souls, are here to help us, you know, live together, get along, you know, create a better world, rethink our universality, our humanity, you know, creating a conference around who we are, talk about who we are, what we do, and how we do it, would be of a great help to sort of open up the discussion into a more sort of sane, you know, decent.
That was Mondo Diane, a Senegalese curator and artist who lives in Chicago. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Cairo, where the Confederation of African Football, CAF, is set to host the 2020-2021 CAF Champions League and CAF Confederations Cup draws for Monday, the 9th of November, 2020. Egyptian clubs Al Ahly and Zamalek, who contest the 2020 CAF Champions League final on November 27th, are among 11 former title holders who have qualified for the next edition. Of the clubs who reached the Champions League quarterfinals this season, only Tunisian outfit Etoile du Sahel failed to make it again, with Esperance and CS Sfaxien representing the nation. Staying with CAF, another candidate has announced his intention to contest for the CAF top job in March 2021. He's Ivory Coast Jacques Anouma. It is the second time Mr. Anouma in 7 years will be contesting for the presidency of CAF after receiving the nomination of his federation for the role ahead of Thursday's deadline. The only other candidate to have signified interest in the job is a reigning CAF president, Ahmed Ahmed. Ahead of this week's CAF 2021 AFCON qualifying series on the continent, Super Eagles of Nigeria head coach Gerard Raw expects to have the full complement of 23 players in camp on Tuesday, ahead of his side's double qualifying fixture against Sierra Leone. The three-time African champions will host the Lone Stars on Friday, November 13th at the Samuel Ogbomedia Stadium in Benin City. Some Super Eagles players have suffered flight cancellations due to the coronavirus pandemic in Europe, which is expected to delay the arrival in camp. In South Africa, Bafana Bafana have confirmed that 6 players have withdrawn from the squad ahead of the upcoming African Cup of Nations qualifiers. Bafana Bafana will face Sao Tome and Principe in back-to-back AFCON qualifiers in South Africa in the next 2 weeks. Away from the AFCON qualifying series, Egypt's under-23 coach Shonki Garib has announced the Olympic team's final squad for the 2 friendly games against South Korea and Brazil within preparations for the Olympic Games next summer. The young Pharaohs started a training camp last week that will see the team face South Korea and Brazil on the 12th and 17th of November, respectively. In athletics, Kenyan runners Bernard Cheruiyot Thiang and Diana Chemtai Kipyoge won the
42nd Istanbul Marathon on Sunday. Sank won the men's race in 2 hours, 11 minutes and 49 seconds. Felix Kimutai, another Kenyan runner, trailed 11 seconds behind Sank, whereas Zewindu Haile Bekele from Ethiopia came third, 34 seconds behind the leader in the men's race. In the women's category, Dinah Kipyoge completed the path in 2 hours, 22 minutes and 6 seconds in the women's race. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a great day. And that's it for this Monday, November 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good week.